Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, August 9th, 2016. We've learned the FBI's spy planes were over Baltimore during the Freddie Gray protest.
Yippee-i-oh.
Yippee-i-oh. Johnny Cash opens our podcast today, Ghost Riders in the Sky, and that's the image I have of these FBI fixed-wing planes that they float in the air above areas that they want to conduct surveillance of. And it probably won't shock you that the ACLU, through a Freedom of Information Act request, has gotten a hold of video footage from FBI surveillance flights over the city of Baltimore during the Freddie Gray protests. There are 18 hours of the video footage. It was captured by a thermal imaging system with infrared cameras mounted on the plane's wing. And I find this interesting, and of course it raises more questions for a guy like me. Because, you know, the idea of the use of helicopters or airplanes to fly over crowd scenes, even those that are potentially going to cross the line into some sort of lawbreaking, that, you know, is a fairly reasonable practice that has been going on for a long time and, to my knowledge, doesn't require a warrant or any other court action for a law enforcement agency to put some eyes in the sky. But my concern is, and this is not addressed by the information provided by the ACLU, did the FBI also have stingrays or dirt boxes on these surveillance planes? Because it's one thing just to keep an eye on people, see where traffic is going, and, you know, figure out if there are any conflict points that require additional law enforcement deployments. But my suspicion, my deep and somewhat informed suspicion, is that these planes were also collecting information from the thousands of cell phones that were carried by protesters and even innocent bystanders in the streets of Baltimore. And that would, in my view, violate the Fourth Amendment. It would essentially be mass surveillance. And it clearly, the Fourth Amendment is clear that you have to have a court order and probable cause before you can conduct intrusive search or surveillance. So I hope that we see more about what the FBI did in Baltimore. And I want to credit Fusion. I think it's .net. Yeah, it's a news site that has a lot of lifestyle information, appears to be aimed at African Americans, and it's the only place that I have seen this story, and so kudos to Fusion.net. Now, the FBI is also under fire because for a number of years now, it's had a voluntary program collecting information from police departments across the country about what are called officer-involved deaths. These are people who've been arrested, are in custody, or who got into some sort of exchange of gunfire with police officers. And this is something that surfaced during the conflicts of the last few years, Michael Brown and Ferguson in particular, where we found that our government didn't have accurate data on the number of Americans killed by law enforcement. And so the Guardian newspaper from London started what they called the Counted. They're doing it again this year. There are over 650 people who have already died in interactions with police officers. Now, some of those are criminals. I want to be clear about that. And, you know, so not every one of these, I'm not implying that every one is a black mark on law enforcement. But the Justice Department has announced in the Federal Register a new program to both collect information from local law enforcement agencies, which will be required to cough it up, and they're going to basically audit the collection of that information by alternately collecting news accounts, media reports, and other information about these kinds of events. So I welcome this. I think that we know last year there were about 2,100 arrest-related deaths across the U.S., involving 1,066 different police departments. And the more information we have on this, the better our better equipped we are to try to deal with the implications of it. And when we don't know, well, what it means is that nobody's lives matter, at least not civilian lives, and police departments can often get away with cover-ups of their own criminal behavior. Also in my FBI file today, Jason Leopold is back at Vice News with a report on two secret letters that the FBI sent to the State Department during the investigation of Hillary Clinton's private email server. And one of them, now disclosed, stemmed from a so-called Section 811 referral from the intelligence community's inspector general. And the IG there determined that classified national security information in Clinton's emails may have been compromised and possibly shared with a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. Now, this Section 811 is the statutory authority that governs the coordination of counter-espionage investigations between executive branch departments and the FBI. A referral like this arises when there is a compromise of classified information for whatever reason. Not only some sort of nefarious action like espionage, but it could be negligence, inadvertence, or, as the FBI director put it, carelessness or extreme carelessness. So this is information that Leopold had sought under the Freedom of Information Act, and the FBI said they couldn't release it because of an ongoing investigation. And once James Comey announced he wasn't going to indict Hillary Clinton, that apparently ended the investigation, and that's why these materials have been released. So the letters were correspondence between the FBI and State Department, and the exchange also exposed that contents of 22 emails were so highly classified that not even the subject matter could be disclosed. Now, this is direct evidence that Hillary Clinton is not telling the truth, and yes, she is lying, when she says, "I never sent or received a classified email." That is not true. And even if she claims short-circuiting or other bizarre reasons for her recent misstatements, we can feel confident that Hillary Clinton has not been honest about the email issues, and we await the resumption of congressional activities after Labor Day when Trey Gowdy and or Daryl Issa over at the House Oversight Committee may bring her up for discussion of possible perjury in relation to sworn testimony that she gave to the Benghazi committee. Now, speaking of Benghazi, Larry Klayman, who is a frequent litigant in federal courts, and not all of it is superfluous or vexatious litigation, but I would put this in that category, he's the guy who runs Judicial Watch. And on some issues, Judicial Watch has been very good in trying to expose government secrecy. And along with the FBI investigation of Hillary's emails, there was a lawsuit brought by Judicial Watch that put pressure on related to the same matters. But now, Klayman is bringing suit on behalf of the families of two Americans who were among the four killed in the assault on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi in 2012. The mother of Foreign Service Information Officer Sean Smith and Charles Woods, the father of Navy SEAL Tyrone Woods, accuse Hillary Clinton of making false and defamatory statements negligently, recklessly, purposefully, and or intentionally with actual malice. So they are using the libel and slander laws to try to prove that Hillary Clinton lied about whether the Benghazi attack was caused by that anti-Muslim video on YouTube. So I don't think this will go anywhere. I think this is a political stunt because a person who serves in high office like a Secretary of State is generally immunized from responsibility for their official actions. And with all the investigations that have been conducted and no, so-called smoking gun surfaced, this reach into libel as a way of trying to bring Hillary Clinton to account for the Benghazi deaths, I think will evaporate pretty quickly. Now, this is a single source report coming from the Duran, which is a Russian media outlet, and it is an interesting angle on the controversy over the emails that have been released by WikiLeaks from the Democratic National Committee. I've been discussing those in some detail, and tomorrow we'll be releasing at NewsBud our latest NewsBud interview with Jim Bamford. James Bamford is the worldwide expert on the NSA and our intelligence communities, and he has some remarkable comments about whether Russia might have been responsible for the hacks and leaks that released the emails. And with Bamford, I discuss the recent comments of Julian Assange, which clearly indicate that the DNC emails were the result of a leak to WikiLeaks and probably not the Russian hacking that also occurred on DNC servers. So what is surfacing here is that because Julian Assange is taking credit and clearly trying to settle scores with candidate Clinton, she and her allies are putting pressure on the government of Ecuador to cancel its asylum protection for Julian Assange at their embassy in London. And we are told by this report from Moscow that in Ecuador, the media is now calling for Assange's asylum status to be reconsidered. Now, I don't know if this will go anywhere, but it certainly shows the sensitivity, if it's true, of the Clinton campaign using every available lever to try to snuff out critical information or sources like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Well, every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Benny Alto up in Oregon, he's got a subscription for each of his three dogs. Isn't that cute? Also, I want to shout out Faith Peoples, who sent me the latest link to a petition online to support pardon or a commutation of the sentence of former Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama from his federal prison plight. And Faith, I really appreciate your support, the information you send. Also, Terry Paris over in Berkeley, keeping things going at the great community station, KPFA. And Anthony Abell, or do you say Abell, just renewed his annual subscription for $50. Thank you, one and all. If you're not a subscriber, you know the drill. You come over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and boom. It's as easy as can be. Well, more and more Republicans are defecting from supporting Donald Trump. The latest is the moderate Republican senator of Maine, Susan Collins, no relation to yours truly. But she said that Trump's proclivity for bullying and invective made it impossible for her to support him. And also yesterday, a big deal was made out of the fact that 50 neocons from the national security and foreign policy sector have signed on to a letter saying, oh, Trump, he's a monster. We can't vote for Trump. And it's the same old people who signed a letter. It's interesting. I went searching for this online, and what first came up was a report from March 3rd, where more than 50 conservative foreign policy experts have signed an open letter condemning Trump as unfit for the office. Well, I guess they figure we weren't paying attention in the primary. So many of the same people, like Michael Hayden, John Negroponte, you remember him, Eric Edelman, and, Tom Ridge, Michael Chertoff, Robert Zoellick, you know these people. They're all part of the Bush neocon mob that got us into all this trouble. And that's why I find this fascinating, because I don't think that Trump is going to be hurt by this. If anybody gets hurt, it will be Hillary Clinton, who is being seen more and more as the choice of the Bush neocons, as the choice of powerful Republicans. And many of us are waiting with bated breath for the announcement that Henry Kissinger has put his full support behind Hillary. And at a certain point, this is counterproductive. We'll see when that point arrives. I want to clue you in that yesterday late I posted a very interesting interview with a journalist who worked at the Boston Globe for many years. His name is Larry Tye, and he's just published a new book about Bobby Kennedy. And as you'll hear in our in-depth interview, I was never in love with Bobby Kennedy. I was fascinated by his brother Jack, but I was pretty young. I was seven when JFK was elected. But by 1968, I was a 15-year-old, and I didn't support Bobby Kennedy when he ran for president that year because I thought he was a chameleon, a guy who would just, you know, take whatever position he needed to get elected. Well, here's an excerpt from my conversation with reporter Larry Tye about Bobby Kennedy.
We grew up in the same era and grew up with the same skepticism, I think, about Bobby Kennedy. He did represent, as Jules Pfeiffer said, and as you said, lots of contradictions. There was a sense that this guy had been there and been a central actor in some of our darkest moments, whether it was getting us into the Cuban Missile Crisis or, much as he denied in his book 13 Days, actually being an advocate in the early days of the missile crisis for bombing the hell out of Fidel Castro's Cuba, to wiretapping Martin Luther King. I could go on and on. He started out as an aide to Senator Joe McCarthy, and all of those were things that either could have forever ruled him out as somebody that I could fall in love with, or, and this may be spin, but I think it's what I honestly believe, having seen the darkest sides of America and having gone over to the light by the end, having grown and having changed in a way that wasn't flip-flopping but was authentic change, I think by the end he was ready on day one to go in there and know how to manipulate the levers of power, to know how to do what was right because he had done what was wrong and what was right. By the end of his life, he was the singly most trusted white man in black America. He was, unlike Eugene McCarthy, who was right on the war in Vietnam by wanting to get us out of that war, McCarthy never did anything and never really understood issues of poverty, issues of racial justice. Bobby Kennedy was a guy who got it all. It wasn't just a candidacy based around the war. And by the end, I think he was precisely the tough liberal, or if you prefer, the tender conservative, that I could believe in.
You can hear the full conversation with Larry Tye about RFK. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and all of our outlets. Yesterday, Donald Trump gave one of those teleprompter speeches. I don't know how all this works within his campaign team and his family, but it appears that he gets himself in trouble with all these freewheeling, ad-libbed comments, his stream of consciousness, and then he decides to impose a little self-discipline. So he went to the Detroit Economic Club, where he gave a speech from a teleprompter, a very wooden delivery, where you could see him turning. You know, the way a teleprompter works is there is a screen on your left and a screen on your right, and you're supposed to just kind of slowly move your head from left to right so that you maintain eye contact with the people in the audience in front of you, but you always can look at your script on one of the two screens. Well, he was just like jerking. He'd look at the left screen, and then he'd turn this way and look at the right screen, and he'd blurt out a sentence with a finger wag. It was a terrible speech. Not only the delivery, the content was his latest draft of economic policy, and it's pretty different. You know, it was just a couple of months ago, he was proposing four tax brackets at 0, 10%, 20%, and 25%. But yesterday, he embraced the Paul Ryan House Republican scheme, which has only three brackets. Low incomes pay 12%, middle 25%, and rich people pay 33%. So this is interesting because the top bracket under Trump's previous proposal had been 39.6%. So this is clearly retooled for political purposes. And who knows how many more economic plans that Trump will trot out between now and November. And who knows if he were elected, if any of these would actually go into effect. Nevertheless, the New York Times just eviscerated his proposal. Oh, he wants to kill the death tax, you know, the estate tax. And he claims that's going to help middle-income people. Well, the way the estate tax is set up now, you have to be worth $6 million as an individual or almost $10 million as a couple before you pay a dime in federal estate tax. And so the real mislead of the speech yesterday was when Trump said that all of his tax cuts would help the middle class. Well, he wants to cut the corporate tax rate in half to 15%. Actually, it's currently at 35%, but nobody pays that rate. The average corporate tax rate last year was 18%. So Trump's proposals would run up the deficit more than Obama could even dream of. And he promises no new regulations. He's still against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's going to put billions of dollars into infrastructure, but doesn't say where he would get the money. And so it's just more nonsense from Donald Trump. This Friday night, I'm going to be attending an event at the University of California, Berkeley. It's part of the National Convention of Veterans for Peace. And I'm really looking forward to this event. If you're in the Bay Area, I invite you to come over to the Pauley Ballroom on the Berkeley campus at 7 p.m. Friday. There is a panel discussion called A Just and Sustainable Future or Extinction. And it features Helen Caldicott, Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, Andrew Bacevich, who I'm really looking forward to hearing. He's been on our podcast many times, and Bacevich is a retired Army colonel. He taught history at Boston University. He lost a son in the war in Iraq. And he is perhaps the most critical militarist voice of U.S. foreign policy blunders in the current era. And so he's also going to be appearing with Roy Scranton and Rodessa Jones. So if you're in the area and you don't have something really ripping to do on Friday night, come on over and maybe I'll see you there. Well, Bernie Sanders made an important statement. But before I tell you what it is, I have to ask Bernie, why did you wait until now? On his Senate website today is a stunning statement that denounces the attempts to impeach Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, and remove her from office. And he demands new elections rather than allowing this interim government of Michel Temer to continue in place. And I'm linking in the show file to this podcast to Glenn Greenwald's coverage. He, of course, lives in Rio and cares a lot about Brazil. And he does a good job of covering Sanders' statement here and the issues that are raised. He also notes that more than 40 members of the House have already signed on to a similar letter, and that, the corruption in Brazil is really wall to wall. And the people who are promoting the impeachment appear to be even more corrupt than they claim the Dilma Rousseff and Lula da Silva administration are. And toward the end of his piece, Greenwald gets to what I raised initially. One question that arises from Sanders' statement is timing. Why, after months of silence on Brazil's political crisis, did he finally speak out now? One of the significant flaws of his candidacy was that he rarely addressed foreign policy at all, notwithstanding the fact that his primary opponent is a war advocate and militarist who was attracting neoconservative support. He was a candidate steadfastly on message. Requests have been made for Sanders by his supporters to speak out on Brazil during the primary, but those requests were rejected or ignored. And Greenwald continues, I'm in agreement with him here, when Sanders did speak on foreign policy, it was to offer the mildest critiques while endorsing many of the fundamentals of the bipartisan war on terror. There were noble exceptions. Some of his statements on Israel and Palestine were among the best from any major party candidate in decades. But by and large, Sanders avoided any foreign policy views that could be castigated as left-wing or out of the mainstream. Somebody posted on my Facebook page a picture of the sign at a Big Boy restaurant. And from my knowledge of the Big Boy chains, you know, there are two of them. There's the Frisch's out of Cincinnati, and there's the Elias Brothers out of Detroit. This looks like an Elias Brothers. Anyway, there is one of these signs where the letters can be changed to promote special features. So this one reads, Endless Seafood Friday Buffet. And a third-party vote isn't a vote for Trump. Fuck you. Now, I don't know who put that up, but he or she is probably no longer working at the Big Boy. And Bernie and Jane Sanders just dropped $600,000 to buy a summer cottage, referred to in Vermont as a camp, on Lake Champlain, Mallets Bay, in the North Hero area of the Champlain Islands. Now, this actually resonates with me because as a young boy, my dad took me to Vermont many summers because his father was born in Burlington. We had relatives there. And when I was about 10, my dad bought a little cottage on Lake Champlain called a camp. And ours was not as cushy as Bernie's. Bernie's is a four-bedroom unit. Ours was just a ramshackle building with a bunk room and a master bedroom and one bathroom and a kitchen. And we were on the lakefront. I spent a lot of time on the water there and really enjoyed it. So I hope in his golden years that Senator Sanders will enjoy his lakefront home in North Hero, Vermont. Here in California, we're really proud that we started waste recycling before many other areas did. And our leadership on this issue is foundering because the market for scrap goods has collapsed worldwide. And it is largely related to the low cost of oil. I hadn't really made that connection. But here in the Bay Area, actually in California, about 20% of our recycling centers have closed, and at the end of January, a single company closed 191 recycling centers across the entire state. And the reason is that the market for recycled stuff has gone down by more than 50% over the last 3 years. And the reason is that virgin materials, let's take a soft drink can, okay? Well, right now it appears to be cheaper to produce a new aluminum beverage can than it is to go to the trouble of collecting, processing, and recycling used cans. So here's a quote from Mark Murray of Californians Against Waste. Energy is so cheap right now that it's much easier for manufacturers of anything, aluminum cans, plastic bottles, to be using virgin material instead of recycled material. In Michigan, we learned over the weekend another alleged case of domestic terrorism. And as I continue to point out to you, every one of these cases seems to include a paid FBI informant or an undercover agent. And I sometimes will tell you as I'm looking at a news report how long it takes for the reporter to mention the undercover FBI informant. Well, this one sets a new record because it's in the second sentence. A man in Michigan who was charged with illegally buying weapons and explosives has alleged links to Al-Qaeda. Sebastian Gregerson, age 29, was arrested Sunday after he swapped a gun for several grenades with an undercover agent. When federal investigators searched his home, they found 7 rifles, 2 guns, 20 knives, and a bunch of ammo. During recorded phone conversations with the undercover agent, Gregerson reportedly talked about making homemade grenades and considered ways to attack buildings and law enforcement. And the other incriminating element in this report is that he had a collection of CDs and DVDs of the sermons of Anwar al-Awlaki, who is seen as the inspiration for many people who want to pledge jihad. And once again, the government is overcharging this guy. They won't let him out on bail. His attorney argued that his client should be released because the undercover agent hadn't provided sufficient information to tie him to any terror network. The government is overstating its case, says the lawyer. And that happens now almost every day. In Pennsylvania, the defiant Attorney General Kathleen Kane remains on the job as she goes on trial. It started yesterday, I believe in Philadelphia, and this is a long-running political battle and scandal in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I want to ask our listeners there, and I can think of Joey Perillo. Joey, if you have any local information, I'd like to learn more about this case, because I've read about Kathleen Kane, and she apparently got into trouble initially because she authorized her staff to release information about who had appeared before a grand jury under her predecessor, So this was not her own grand jury. This is one that had been formed. The individual who was examined was not charged with anything. And so she authorized the release of non-secret information. But she's charged with perjury, lying to the grand jury, 8 misdemeanor counts that include obstruction, official oppression, conspiracy, false swearing. But she also released email chains that showed that 2 members of the state Supreme Court were using their email for offensive, racist comments and sometimes exchanging pornographic content. So 2 Supreme Court justices were forced to step down because of what she revealed. So this makes it hard for a guy in a room in California to understand the dimensions of this, how much of it is pure politics, and whether or not Kathleen Kane is responsible or guilty of any of these crimes. Now, we'll leave it to the trial and a jury to give us a pronouncement on that. But if any of our Pennsylvania listeners have opinions, please share them with me. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. And finally today, a bizarre ruling by a federal court, an appeals court in New York, that benefits the Chevron oil company to the tune of $9 billion. Now, this is a long-running case going back to the time in the 1990s, before Chevron took over Texaco. Texaco had oil fields in the Ecuadorian rainforest, and they left a huge mess there. That isn't much in dispute. But Chevron says, look, we paid $40 million to clean up what we think Texaco was responsible for, and then a bunch of greedy lawyers from the U.S. and from Ecuador gamed a case against us and manipulated it. And it is fair to say that the lawyers did appear to pull some fast moves, and there were some eyebrow-raising methods that were used to win this conviction. But it is amazing that a U.S. court can deny the execution of a judgment that came from a court in Ecuador. Now, the fine print here shows that the appeals court upheld a judge's finding that the $9 billion judgment was obtained through bribery, coercion, and fraud. But the ruling noted that the original decision by that judge does not invalidate the Ecuadorian judgment and doesn't stop the enforcement of the judgment outside the United States. Now, Chevron has a lot of interests all over the world, so it might be feeling, you know, some sort of satisfaction that it has beaten the collection in the United States. But I think Ecuador will find ways to collect it elsewhere. This story ain't over. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. It's a free podcast, and you're free to share it with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until